Blog Talk Radio.
That was the great Oscar Peterson, one of the greatest jazz pianist players who ever lived. The fastest fingers and the fastest of thinking ability that I've ever heard. We'll be doing a show strictly on him, like we're doing a show this week on the great Charlie Parker. Charlie Parker, we started last week with Charlie Parker, and we decided we're going to continue with Charlie Parker. This is Getting It Done, and I am your host, Dr. Walter Dean. Charlie Parker, we got a lot of information about him last week. We're going to continue with some more information on the great Bird.
This was part two of Bird Song. The story of Charlie Parker.
Thank you.
hip-hop was not a revolution, as people have said. It really was an evolution. It came forth out of the music which had gone before. It was really wonderful for me. I met Dizzy Gillespie and Charlie Parker at the Howard Theater in Washington, D.C. when I was a kid. They were much older than I was. As a matter of fact, Bird was my age. And he was a little old.
Superimposed on the old song tune Whispering, played by the Dizzy Gillespie Sextet featuring Charlie Parker in February 1945. Dr. Billy Taylor, pianist and educator, was getting to know that style of music at the time.
Dizzy, he didn't figure out a lot of those things per se, but he was an arranger and he wanted to hear certain sounds, and he would go to the piano and try to work it out and then apply that to the orchestras that he was writing for or playing with. He took this which is really a 13th chord. If you're going to do that chord, then it's proper. What it probably would be this. No, but they raised this so that you had the seventh, the ninth in a proper place, a raised 11th, and a 13th. Dizzy said when he heard that, he heard this melody. And so he made that melody go with the harmonies, and you know, we all learned a lot from it.
There were many shades of reaction to the new music. Some young listeners liked it simply because it was exciting and because they weren't put off by a knowledge of the complexities that went into it. Some established musicians were alienated or even frightened by it, even though it was based on things they knew, like the tune Whispering. Professor Dan Morgenstern of the Institute for Jazz Studies at Rutgers University puts it like this.
Certainly the basic elements remains, but a very high speed, high velocity, demanding, especially the speed. I mean, I don't think anybody, I don't care who it is, has ever matched what Dizzy and Charlie could do together. When they play unison, Sure Enough is probably the best example of that. When they played that line together, nobody has ever matched that. And that is hard. That's hard.
Sure Enough, again by Dizzy Gillespie and his old firm was one of those defining numbers that gave the listening public their first complete idea of bebop, and with it, the notion of a kind of double act between Gillespie and Parker, a notion which tended to stick. The two pioneers had indeed worked up some aspects of the music together, and they were now in the recording studio together. But as Lauren Schoenberg, executive director of the National Jazz Museum in Harlem, emphasizes, there was always a certain distance between them.
You know, it's funny, Charlie Parker and Dizzy Gillespie did not record together that much. I mean, they're on record in like early to mid 45, then throughout late 45 into early 46. Then there's really nothing. Then there's a very bad sounding recording of Bird with Dizzy's band, which, you know, you really can't hear anything. Then there's the Carnegie Hall concert in 47 where they play together. Then there's, I guess, the Metronome All-Stars, and then there's the record date with Monk, and then there's a reunion, I think, in 51 or so with Bud Powell and some people, Roy Haynes. There's not that much.
Well, it does add up, but a lot of those later meetings did have the character of reunions, and one of the early ones was a kind of farewell to the swing era, a session convened by the vibraphonist, xylophonist, bandleader, Red Norvo.
Somebody called me in the morning. And said, I'm from Cleveland. I'd like for you to do a record day. And I said, oh, I do too many. I don't really don't want to do any more record days. And I said, well, I'll tell you what. If you let me to get the guys I want to get and let me pay them what I want to pay them, I'll do a date for you. So how much you want to pay them? I said, well, everybody's got to get at least double scale and more. And so they give me so much and this, that, and the other thing. So I forgot about it. I thought, well, that'll hang him up anyway. So about 2 weeks later, he calls the same time at 8 o'clock in the morning. I said, okay, on that record date. I said, what are you talking about? I didn't remember. So he said, I'm the guy from Cleveland. I said, oh. He said, it's okay. Will you go ahead and do it? I said, yeah, okay. So that's when I got people together for this date. And we had no music in the studio. We just walked in the studio and did the date. Yeah, we didn't have any idea what we're going to play or anything.
First recording session under Charlie Parker's own name was convened, and it was a typically complex event. To play trumpet, he had hired a promising young Juilliard student called Miles Davis, but it would seem that the young man warmed up to playing some of the more agitated lines in the chosen themes. So, Dizzy Gillespie turned up to play those, and also a good deal of the piano on the session, a task for which the pianist R. Garman Thornton, later known as Sadiq Hakim, had been officially hired, in the absence of Parker's closest stylistic follower on piano, Bud Powell. So it was a session where Gillespie was officially absent, but actually haunted the entire proceeding. The session by Charlie Parker's Reboppers, an interesting variation in nomenclature, was a wonderful one. The blues riff theme called Now's the Time was later ripped off severally, notably as a dance craze called the Hucklebuck. And then, at the end of the session, there was Coco, K-O-K-O, a theme overlaid on the pattern of Cherokee, in Charlie Parker's formative days, his favorite practice piece, especially the challenging mid-eight. Here, Gillespie provided both the tricky trumpet introduction and then the piano accompaniment. As for Parker's solo, the jazz writer Gary Giddings has said this,
bam, he just flies in there for 64 astonishing measures. And in the course of it, he, at the one hand, he introduces completely new kind of riffs, which are very dissonant. At one point, it's almost like a, you know, throwing a tomato at a window or something. That kind of thing. And then another point, he begins with the oldest, horriest riff in the entire jazz canon from High Society. So fast, and just making it work in those chords, so that in a sense you're hearing the history of jazz, but refracted to a completely new kind of personality.
Probably came from James C. Johnson or Duke Ellington or someone else. But what he did, you see, it was sort of a scramble before Charlie Parker came on the scene. And so this wasn't actually together until Charlie Parker came in with the identification of the style.
Dizzy Gillespie lived long enough to parcel out the credit a little for the bebop movement, though Thelonious Monk was so individualistic as to be scarcely in it or of it. Gillespie was about to move pretty successfully into the big band field, and he always had ancillary talents, some might say diversionary tactics, going for him.
Let's not forget, as you well know, that Gillespie was a nonpareil clown, and always was. You have to be so careful when you say that, because people will take clown to be pejorative. But any of us who knew Dizzy and played with him or saw him, I mean, gosh, he wiggled his rear end and he laughed and he told jokes and he did the same comedy routines. I mean, comedy was a big part of his presentation.
So Dizzy was right at home when Slim Gaylard, guitarist and bizarre fantasist of song, called both him and Parker into the studio for a session credited grandiosely to Slim Gaylard and his orchestra. The most famous of the tracks was set up as a fake jam session, though there were elements of truth within the blarney.
See, this sounds so fun. Say, you better bring me a double order of Reetie Footies with a little hot sauce on it. That'll just start fixing. Oh, here's this. Well, look at Charlie Yard.
Boy, the Rooney.
Now, how's it going, Jim?
Oh, everything is mellow, man. Look at this. Get this horn with the name.
Yeah,
blow
I got
some horn with the man. I want to blow something.
Yeah, read trouble.
I'm got to read.
Yeah.
Well, my office's got to read. You can trim it down a little. That's great.
Yeah, that's great.
Well, that's
great.
Solid, then. Well, let's get together and blow. We need flat. Take the next. You got it.
Got it.
All right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, look at him. There's McKevin also Rooney with his trumpet there. Everything is solid. Well, you got to cut out. Jubilee got to make another day. That's true. What you got to make a gig? Sing next chorus before you cut out. Sing next chorus. That's killer.
It's quite true that Gillespie had to go on to record an Armed Forces radio show called Jubilee that day. So did Parker. They were recorded there, playing, among other things, two numbers we've heard already, Sure Enough and Groove and I. These latter sessions were recorded in Hollywood. The Parker Gillespie group had gone west to play a residency at Billy Berg's club, where new flavors were added, among them Milt Jackson on vibraphone.
I was in Seventh Heaven three times, tripled over. I mean, I was getting the best education. I was going to the greatest conservatory in the world every single night for 8 solid weeks.
Some great music was played, but California audiences were largely baffled by what they still heard as a New York phenomenon. And organizationally, things began to fall apart. A record session produced just one track because Milt Jackson didn't get there, Charlie Parker very nearly didn't, and there was no sign either of his early hero Lester Young, who was supposed to be there. Instead, the studio was crammed with friends, acquaintances, and downright Butinskis, so that only a theme called Diggin' Diz was recorded. When the session was rearranged, Charlie Parker was the one who didn't show up.
It was Dilly who seemed to have the consciousness of himself as an entertainer, and after all, the uniform of that period was Dizzy's uniform, the goatee beard and the beret and all the rest of it, you know. Charlie Parker didn't seem to have ideas of presenting himself.
No, he didn't. That wasn't his nature. He was a Midwestern guy, and he came up, I'll play the music, and the music will speak for itself. It wasn't that he wasn't aware of that, because he played in big bands in the Midwest and everything, but it was a different time. He was ready to sort of play longer lines and to play longer choruses and to do something musically and more adventurous than I think even Dizzy was ready for at that particular time. You have to remember that was a period of the 78 records, and so you could only play 3 minutes on a record, so you had to play within that space.
And you had to be in shape to do it, something that would soon matter a great deal to Charlie Parker and his career. His addiction still had hold of him. And West Coast prices for his desired fix were several times those he was used to in New York. But disaster was a while coming. The first bad sign was that when Dizzy and the rest of the group from New York flew back there, Charlie cashed in his plane ticket and stayed in California. The news in California were not all bad. Parker did begin to play for the impresario Norman Grant, a future supporter of his career, whose semi-competitive arranged jam session concerts called Jazz at the Philharmonic were just beginning to build an audience. Parker knew all about jam session routines from life in Kansas City, as indeed did Lester Young, who was also on the bill. Parker's contribution to the rendition of Lady Be Good, a Lester Young speciality, is the classic instance of Charlie's turning popular song material into blues. After that, Parker had another session, only his second, under his own name, and it was another triumph. This time, young Miles Davis had to stand alone, and his eggshell tone did tend to break. He splits a lot of notes on his early records with Parker, but his pleasingly shy approach, later modified into the annoying stance called cool, fitted well opposite Parker's now masterly confidence. And some of the material was more inviting than usual, even by bebop terms, easy. Many a listener then and later must have been drawn into this music through the comparative relaxation of Yardbird's Suite. One Gillespie tune was played on the date, not out of affection for the departed Dizzy so much as because it contained the irresistible challenge of a virtuoso high-speed break which Parker took on alone. On the takes where the band got things pretty well right, he played the break pretty well. But on the take where they messed up, he played it as he would have wished. It's now issued separately on Charlie Parker compilations and discussed by musicologists under the name of The Famous Alto Break. Session was deeply ponderable, although the odd confusion arose. The title Moose the Mooch was thought by some to refer to the brilliant and eccentric white piano player Dodo Marmarosa, who was on the session and whose nickname was Moose. But Moose the Mooch, real name Emery Bird, B-Y-R-D, was a far more sinister character, Charlie Parker's drug supplier, certainly not a figure deserving of the memorable theme that bears his name. Royalties to Moose the Mooch, his heroin contact. It was the temporary absence of the Mooch from circulation which caused the breakdown of Charlie's music, his personality, and for a time his career in midsummer 1946. A Dial record session featuring the Charlie Parker Quintet had been arranged for the 29th of July. But Parker, his heroin supply cut off, turned up in a dreadful condition, having sought to cure his ills with an ocean of straight whiskey and probably pills. Trumpeter Howard McGee did his best to rescue the faster pieces, but Parker didn't have the articulation left in his fingers to deal with those. But there remains the ballad piece, Lover Man, which is a testament to what Parker could do in spite of all, in spite of forgetting, for example, to come in at the beginning of the first chorus. I asked one of the great British alto players in the Parker tradition, Peter King, what he thought about it.
People have now got around to saying the original Lover Man is a thing of beauty anyway. But
well, it's always been a thing of emotional beauty. I mean, you can't dissociate it from the story around it. I mean, it certainly moved me tremendously, you know. But, I mean, I never considered it a great musical a thing. But the power of it is astonishing, you know, when you know what he went through. And I've experienced a little bit of that myself. And I know what it's like. You're trying to play when you're sick. And it's just very, very moving.
Was persuaded to return to the Civic Hotel where he was staying, but later wandered into the lobby wearing little if anything while attempting to use the payphone. He later fell asleep while smoking and set fire to his hotel room, and then proved violent and abusive to those trying to restore order. He was rendered unconscious by one means or another and came to in the state hospital, a mental facility in the township of what musicians tend to call Camarillo and modern Californians Camarillo. Next time, we'll see what happened when Charlie Parker was restored to society and how his music fought to remain ahead of his chemical demons. I'm Russell Davis, and this was an Associated Rudy Fusion production for BBC Radio 2. The producer was Graham Pass. This is Russell Davis with part two of...
Yes, that was part two of the story of Yardbird, Charlie Parker, the great bird. There's some things in there that I didn't even know about Charlie Parker. And this is Dr. Walter Dean, broadcasting for you on a program that I have named called Getting It Done. And we're going to go on and continue with the Parker, and we're going to be listening to an interview done by Paul Desmond, who played saxophone for the the Rondo songs, the things that were done like Take Five, But here he is, 1954, being interviewed.
Child of jazz, says Charlie Parker, the creator of bop, in a series of interviews that took more than 2 weeks, told us he felt that bop is something entirely separate and apart from the older tradition, that it drew little from jazz, has no roots in it. The chubby little alto man, who has made himself an international music name in the last 5 years, added that bop, for the most part, had to be played by small bands. He stated, Gillespie's playing has changed from being stuck in front of a big band. Anybody's does. He's a fine musician. The leopard coats and the wild hats are just another part of the manager's routines to make him box office. The same thing happened a couple of years ago when he stuck his name on some tunes of mine to give him a better commercial reputation. As to define bop, after several evenings of argument, Charlie was still not precise in his definition. It's just music, he said. He's trying to play clean and looking for the pretty notes. Pushed further, he said that a distinctive feature of bop is its strong feeling for beat. The beat in a bop band is with the music, against it, behind it, Charlie said. It pushes it, it helps it, helping the beat clean. It has no continuity of beat, no steady chug-chug. Jazz has, and that's why bop is inflexible. He admits the music eventually may be atonal. Bop himself is a devout admirer of Paul Hindemith, the German neoclassicist, raves about his Kammermusik and Sonata for viola and cello. He insists, however, that bop is not moving in the same direction as modern classical. He feels that it would be more flexible, more emotional, more colourful. He reiterates constantly that bop is only just beginning to form as a school, that it can barely label its present trends, much less make prognostications about the future. The closest Parker will come to an exact technical description of what may happen is to say that he would like to emulate the precise, complex, harmonic structures of Hindemith, but with an emotional colouring and dynamic shading that he feels modern classical lacks. Parker's indifference to the revered jazz tradition certainly will leave some of his own devotees in a state of surprise. But, actually, he himself has no roots in traditional jazz. During the few years he worked with traditional jazzmen, he wandered like a lost soul. In his formative years, he never heard any of the music which is traditionally supposed to inspire young jazzists. No Lewis, no Bix, no Hawk, no Bennett, no nothing. His first musical idol, the musician who so moved and inspired him that he went out and bought his first saxophone at the age of 11, was Rudy Valli. Tossed into the jazz world of the mid-30s with this kind of background, he had no familiar ground on which to stand. For 3 years, he fumbled unhappily until he suddenly stumbled on the music which appealed to him, which had meaning to him. For Charlie insists, music is your own experience. Your thoughts, your wisdom. If you don't live it, it won't come out of your home.
Now, what I'm going to do right now is skip way ahead to another segment of that particular part because much of this deals with Charlie's early years, and last week we talked a lot about his early years. Let's skip ahead to Charlie Parker later on.
Guitar, piano, and sax books with him and set about learning to read seriously. The pianist, Carrie Powell, played for him and taught him simple major, minor, seventh, and diminished chords. By the end of the Elden job in April, he could read fairly well, but not quickly. He went back to Kansas City and got his first job at 18th and Lydia at either the Panama or the Florida Blossom, he can't remember which. It paid him 75 cents a night. The main idea of the job, Charlie recalls, was to be there and hold a note. Soon after this, he tried jamming for the first time at the Hyatt at 22nd Vine. He knew a little of Lazy River and Honeysuckle Rose and played what he could. He didn't find it difficult to hear the changes because the numbers were easy and the reed men set a riff only for the brass, never behind a reed man. No two horns jammed at the same time. I was doing all right until I tried doing double tempo on Body and Soul, Charlie says. Everybody fell out laughing. I went home and cried. I didn't play again for 3 months. In 1937, he joined J. McShannon's band, but left after 2 weeks. Later, he was arrested for refusing to pay a cab fare. His mother, who didn't approve of his conduct then, wouldn't help him out, and he was jugged for 22 days.
Okay, now, we have just about given you as much as we can about Charlie Parker, and the clock on the wall says if you're going to do something else, you might as well do it now, and that's what I'm planning on doing. Let me get on to some other people, and this one right here is the counterpart of Charlie Parker, and that was Dizzy Gillespie. Let's listen to what he has to say.
And through the years, this accumulated, this condition. It is a condition.
Oh, I see. When you started, it didn't go that way.
No, it's a condition because...
You're talking about like that goes for you right
yeah.
now. Uh-huh.
Well, a little bit of time, I guess.
Can I say that again?
Three or two.
My goodness, is that from the muscles weakening?
I don't know. I don't sound too weak. But I do that. I guess maybe it's a weakening of the muscle. But let me show you what happens. You know, in the fireplace,
mm-hmm.
when you get these things, the bellows, when you pull the bellows out, the bellows, you see? Now, when you push those bellows in, if you have something over the end of this thing, it'll just swell, you know what I'm saying? And then when you say, like that, the note comes out. So that's how my attack is.
You said somewhere that every day this trumpet gets harder and harder.
Yeah.
I would think after the years it'll get easier.
No, man. If you live to be 1,000 years old and you've never mastered this boy. It waits in the chase like this. And looking up at you. And when you open the chase, it says,
You think you're going to play me?
Yeah. And don't be reticent about, you know, like you know, playing the trumpet. You have forceful, and you say, pow, like that. And you have some say, you know, like that. So sometimes, if you fool around, you know, warm it up, you know, you would say, it takes that.
The trumpet detects it.
The trumpet itself detects that. You say, uh-huh. Got it. And then when you get ready to push, it won't do it. So you have to fight it. You're in a boxing match all the time with it. You're fighting.
See, I would think some musicians would see it as a love affair, you know, like a harpsichord player.
Yeah, well, you ever see two fighters when the someone's beating the hell out of one another? They're hugging. And so I do it with my brother.
The thing actually has made you famous, if not rich.
It is. It is charged daily for it.
you grew up a poor boy in a small southern town.
Yes, yes.
Where are you from?
Chiro, South Carolina.
Chiro?
Chiro. C-H-E-R-A-W. It has made me an honorary man. Chiro, South Carolina.
Now, how did a poor boy in Chiro take up the trumpet? Your daddy played, didn't he?
Yeah, but he didn't play the trumpet. There was no trumpet in my house. And then my father never saw me play. But he died when I was 9 and a half.
Mm-hmm.
So I hadn't started playing and fooling around, you know, picking some notes out of Coonshine Lady on the piano.
Mm-hmm.
But even
where did the trumpet come from? How'd you learn that?
High school. I mean the junior, you know, in ninth grade. 1 year, the state bought them instruments, and everybody was rushing to try to get an instrument. Man, all everybody, and I was little. I was only about 12 maybe, and I said, "Oh, let me get this." And when I got there, man, the only thing left was a trombone.
I told you.
Yeah, I couldn't reach on to the fourth position. There was that much more that I couldn't get.
Yeah.
So, but I took that anyway.
So the kid next door had a trumpet, and you had a trombone.
Yeah, and I liked the trumpet. So he let me practice on his trumpet when I get a chance when he was. And then they saw that I was interested in that. And Miss Alice Wilson, the teacher, a former group in school. This lady is remarkable. She's about 80-something years old now. And she's still alive and very youthful in demeanor. So her whole expression is an example of her expression. Her name is Miss Alice Wilson.
She even remembered you only by your real name, John Birch.
Yeah. Most of people. And sure, I'll call me that.
So where did you get this name, Dizzy?
Dizzy came from Philadelphia.
Your family moved up. Your mama moved to Philadelphia after your daddy died, huh?
Yeah.
In South Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
You were playing the trumpet by then.
Oh, yeah.
You said you got to Philly and they called you Dizzy. How come?
Well, I don't know. That's just weird ways I had it. I don't know. Maybe it's in my book. And my book, yeah. It tells stories.
What do you think was the most the busiest thing you did in those days?
I don't remember doing nothing. To tell you the truth, in Philadelphia.
Ain't care they call you that, huh?
No, I was always the most intelligent guy in the crowd that I went around with.
You didn't carry around your trumpet in an old paper bag?
Yeah.
Those of you who do not realize that that was a thing from Dizzy Gillespie, who I consider to be one of the greatest jazz trumpet players, not the greatest trumpet player, but one of the greatest trumpet players, who played a lot with the Charlie Parker. These two people are the engineers of the bebop period. These two people were the engineers in the real kind of jazz that is played today, but in another way. And I just can't tell you enough about the amount of respect I had for both of those particular men. But what is so great is that both of them are from Charlie Parker was from Kansas City, Dizzy Gillespie from South Carolina. Now, we're going to listen for the last bit to a young man who had some physical deformities, and his name is Michael Piccicelli. Michael was like a midget, I guess you might want to call him. He's only about 5 feet, not even 5 feet. He might have been like 4'10", but had to have... what you call that, to sit down in a chair on the piano, he had to have a stool that was low enough for him, and if it wasn't, he had some books to play the piano. They had to move the pedal and rearrange the pedal on the piano he played. And he's still alive today, but let's give a listen to this fantastic piano player, who I thought myself, personally, is a great pianist, not one of the greatest, but great piano player, playing the Summer in Italy, live at the I think it was a concert that he did in 1990. Let's check it out. Thank you.
Thank you.
that was Michael Piccicelli. It's called A Summer in Altelia, or Estate, live at the Metro 1990 Jazz Concert. It was recorded on August 6, 2011. This has been Getting It Done, and your host, Dr. Dean. Better still, Dr. Walter Dean. The man may be short and small and statue, but fantastic, is a giant at the piano. Fantastic. We've been listening to a number of things. Let me back and review. We started off the show this morning, or this evening, with the great Oscar Peterson, the greatest jazz pianist I've ever heard. Maybe somebody else has heard somebody better, but I have not heard anybody better, whose hands were like machines. And then we went forward and listened to the last parts of the Charlie Parker's life. In my book called Legends, I most of the stuff that you heard and some other things are in that book that will be published pretty soon. I'm adding a few other individuals. And then after we did with Charlie Parker, I decided to sort of veer off a little bit and let you hear somebody who had some physical disability. And so next week I plan on doing, that was Michael. Next week I plan on doing some more stuff with some very, very interesting individuals, to be perfectly honest with you. People that you might find very, very interesting, and we're going to sort of close the show with let's go ahead and pull Michael up and see. We won't be able to hear all of the song that he's doing. We will be able to hear some of the song that will be played right now. And that is called Michael. No, we don't have time. I only have about 10 seconds. But what we're going to be doing is listen to this lady right here and end the show. I want to say thank you for listening. It has been a pleasure providing you with a different perspective on jazz with the great Charlie Parker, as well as Michael Piccicelli, as well on, sir, the great pianist, who I think is probably the greatest of all time. So until next week, look forward to hearing from you by listening. And if not, give me a call. And let me know that you enjoyed the show. Till next week, this has been Getting It Done with your host, Dr. Walter Dean.